requests for you. First, if you take photos of me, please do not post them on Facebook, Instagram, or WhatsApp. That company is a monstrous surveillance engine. It does surveillance on its useds. It doesn't have users, it has useds. And it does surveillance on the rest of the internet too, through like buttons. And it uses face recognition to track people. So if you post a photo with somebody's face in it, in that company, you're helping that company track that person. I recommend you not do that to your friends, and please don't do that to me. Please also don't, if you take a photo with an eye thing, make sure that the iCloud feature is turned off so it won't send the photo immediately to an Apple server. And if you use an Android device, please make sure that the feature that automatically does a Google search with every photo you take is turned off, because if you did that, you'd be letting those companies track me, which is a bad way to treat someone. Second, if you make a recording and you want to distribute copies, please do so only in the formats that are favorable to free software, that is, the OGG formats or WebM. Please do not distribute in the MP formats because they're patented. Especially do not distribute in Flash, because Flash requires non-free software to watch. And to also avoid Windows Media Player, RealPlayer, and QuickTime. Please make sure that the distribution site, in its normal operation, lets users download a copy without running any non-free software. Now that might be JavaScript software in the page itself. That's one of the problems with YouTube. YouTube normally distributes WebM, which is a fine format to use, but it's set up so people can't see it unless they run the non-free software in the page. If you know how, you can bypass that with YouTube DL, but we've got to consider that most people would look at YouTube through the normal mechanism, so please don't put it there. And please put on the recording the Creative Commons No Derivatives license, because this is a presentation of a point of view. So, what is free software? First of all, it's free as in freedom. It's libre, not gratis. It's not a question of price at all. So, in the introduction, talking about price was actually a distraction from the issue. In the free software movement, we're not concerned with whether you pay to get a copy of a program. It's okay if you get it gratis, it's okay if you pay for one. The issue is, once you've got a copy, does it respect your freedom or does it take your freedom away? That's what makes the program ethical or unethical. Well, what is a program and what's a computer? A computer is a conceptually simple, universal machine. It only knows how to get the next instruction and execute it and then repeat over and over. Get the next instruction and execute it. The instructions come from a program. So, depending on what program it's running, the computer could do anything at all. Well, almost anything. There are some things it can't do. So who gives the instructions to your computer? You might think it's you, when really, it's someone else. You might think your computer is obeying you, when really, it's obeying someone else first, and you second. With any program, there are two possibilities. Either the users control the program, or the program controls the users. It's always one or the other. When the users control the program, that's free software. What is freedom? Freedom is having control of your own life, having control of the activities you do in your life. So if you do the activity by using a program, you need to have control over what that program does. So when the users control the program, that program respects their freedom. In order for the users to control the program, they need the four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish for any purpose. Freedom one is the freedom to study how the program works and change it so it does your activities the way you wish. For that to be practical, not just theoretical, you need the source code of the program. Here you can see some source code. It's sort of like math together with text. And if you understand programming, you can see what that does. You can tell what the program would do, and you can see how to change it. There's an executable program. It's a bunch of ones and zeros. Even for an expert to figure out what that program does is difficult. So in order for freedom one to be real and practical, not merely theoretical, users have to have the source code. Now, these two freedoms give each user separately control over the program. So I can change my copies, and you can change your copies. Here we see one user who's decided to change her copies, and three other users who are using the program without changing it. Each one of them has freedom separately to change the program. This separate control is essential but not enough, because a lot of users don't know how to program. Most people don't know how to program. In fact, they do other things. There are a lot of things in the world to do. At least so far. So, if all people get is separate control, that's not enough. We need collective control too, which is the freedom to work with others to change the program, to participate in a group with others that want to collaborate with you. Here we see a group of three users that are working together to change the program, to do what they want. Two of them are actually changing the program. I guess they're programmers. And then there's a third who's not actually changing the program. Maybe he doesn't know how to program. But together they decide what changes to make. So they all participate in exercising control over what that program does. This is how non-programmers can participate in exercising control over their software and their computing. Not everybody has to be in the group. You know, the people who work together are those that choose to work together. Here we see two other users of the same program who are not participating in that group. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe those three don't want to work with them. Maybe they're just interested in doing different things and have no interests in common. Who knows? But they're all free to work together when they want to with whoever wants to work with them. Collective control requires two more essential freedoms. Freedom two is the freedom to make exact copies and then give or sell them to others when you wish. And freedom three is to make copies of your modified versions and give or sell them to others when you wish. One particular part of these freedoms, one subcase of them, is sharing. Sharing is when you non-commercially redistribute copies to others. Sharing is an essential part of the bonds of society. Therefore, people must be free to share copies of any published work. Any attempt to stop or forbid people from sharing copies is an attack on social solidarity, an attack on society. Laws which forbid sharing are directly unjust. We must get rid of those. And therefore, therefore, we should reject propaganda terminology such as pirate, which is used to demonize people who share, who help each other. The term pirate, well, piracy is attacking ships, and it's very bad. So when people apply that to sharing, what they're saying is helping other people is the moral equivalent of attacking ships. That's from their point of view because they're practicing divide and rule. So let's not give any support to their evil cause. Let's not repeat that propaganda term. Let's refuse to refer to sharing as, quote, piracy, unquote. When people ask me what I think of piracy, I say attacking ships is very bad. Let's send the Navy. And when people ask me what I think of movie piracy, I say I like the first Pirates of the Caribbean. And if people ask me about music piracy, well, I could sing some of My Name is Captain Kidd, who did sail, who did sail, but I won't bore you with the rest. The point is, never accept the idea that, quote, piracy, unquote, refers to sharing. So, if the program comes with these four freedoms, the users have control over the program, it's freedom respecting free software. But if one of these freedoms is missing or insufficient, then the users don't control the program. Instead, the program controls the users, and the developer controls the program, which means this program generates a system of unjust power, power of the developer over the users. By the way, if you're carrying a portable tracking and surveillance device, please turn it off. They've already tracked you here. They already know you're listening to me. And I believe a recording is being made, so if they want to hear what I say, they don't have to listen through your portable tracking and surveillance device, which they can do at any time, you know. They can just listen to the recording once it's published. So, this is already unjust. Non-free software is an injustice, a system of power that nobody should have. But it leads to additional injustices, because once a company has this kind of power, what's it going to do? It's going to look for ways to take advantage of that power to get more power. So they put in malicious functionalities, such as spying on users. The iThings have an iBeacon, which is a transmitter that makes it easy to follow them around, for instance, in a store, and there are stores that put these sensors in. The Amazon Swindle spies on the user and it reports from time to time the title of the book being read and which page, and it also reports any notes that the user enters or any underlining, all that gets sent to Amazon. Then there's the functionality of refusing to function. I'm talking about DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, or digital handcuffs. The intentionally designed functionality of refusing to do what the users obviously want. Now, I'm not talking about a mere omission. It's not that they just didn't bother implementing everything the users would like. That in itself is not culpable. Of course, stopping the users from adding what's missing by making the program non-free, that is culpable. But merely failing to add a feature is not. However, that's not what happens here. They worked for years figuring out ways to make it impossible for users to do the things they know users will want to do. So here is the dreaded Blu-ray that attacks any users who want to share. And many non-free programs have DRM. Then there are back doors which enable sorts of sabotage. It means someone can remotely send a command to do something nasty to the user. For instance, the Amazon Swindle has a back door for remotely erasing books. We know this because in 2009, Amazon remotely erased thousands of copies of a particular book, an Orwellian act. And what was the book? It was 1984 by George Orwell. If this were fiction, I wouldn't dare make that up. People would say it's too unbelievable. But this is what happened, showing us that the device is monstrous. Amazon, responding to a lot of criticism, promised it would never do this again, unless ordered to by the state. Which is not a very comforting promise, but don't worry, Amazon didn't keep it anyway. It wasn't a serious promise. It's one of those promises that are meant to cause temporary confusion to critics, and by the time they discover it's a lie, they've lost their momentum. The guy who increased the price of a medicine by 500%, was it 5,000%, I think, he did the same thing. He said, I'll reduce it, and then he didn't. And then there's censorship, pioneered by the iThings. They do censorship of apps. The user can't freely install whatever app she wants to install. She's limited to the apps approved by Apple and posted in Apple's store. Apple practices this censorship in arbitrary ways. For instance, an app that would show people information about US drone attacks has been censored based on bizarre excuses. Information about where to get an abortion has been censored. However, the phony crisis pregnancy centers that are meant to mislead women so that they don't get abortions, they are present. Apple approves of them. Of course, even if Apple's preferences agreed with my political views, I would still condemn censorship. When the users found ways to get around the censorship, they called it jailbreaking, recognizing that these computers are jails for their users. So that's our term for a computer that censors applications. It's a jail. Microsoft does the same thing. And then there is sabotage. When Sony initially sold the PlayStation 3, it had two modes of operation. You could play games on Sony's gaming network or install another operating system, such as the GNU system. Then somebody found a way using the GNU system to break some DRM, and so Sony decided to withdraw that mode of operation. But how could it do that to the products already sold? Sony released a firmware downgrade, saying, if you install this downgrade, you will no longer be able to run the GNU system. But if you don't install this downgrade, you won't be able to talk on the gaming network anymore because they changed the protocol and the old version didn't work. So they forced every user to choose to lose one half of the functionality or the other half. Sabotage. But there's more direct sabotage. Some systems have universal backdoors by which they can forcibly change the software at a distance, at any time. They can install any change at all. So it's a universal backdoor in the same way that a computer is a universal computing device. Windows is an example. Windows XP had a universal backdoor. It was hidden. But people figured it out. In Windows 10, they admitted. This shows how ethical standards continue to fall. Windows XP had spy functionalities that Microsoft did not acknowledge. Windows 10, they say you agree that they can look at any file on the system at any time through their universal spying facilities, and that they can impose any change, whatever they want. So, the universal backdoor is the ultimate in malware, because it means they can do any nasty thing to the user at any time. Any malicious functionality that is not in Windows today could be remotely installed tomorrow. By the way, there is a universal backdoor also in the Amazon Swindle and in nearly all portable phones. Android has something that's more or less equivalent to a universal backdoor. One non-free component of Android is Google Play. It has a backdoor which can be used to forcibly deinstall or install any application. I don't know whether that's completely equivalent to a universal backdoor or not, but at least it's quite powerful as a backdoor. Another way of mistreating the users is what Microsoft does with Windows. It shows the NSA security flaws in Windows before it fixes them, thus giving the NSA an opportunity to attack Microsoft's own users. I read about this in Bloomberg News. There was an article, I think it was a different one, saying, can anyone trust Microsoft ever again? Well, the answer obviously is no. Well, these examples of malware, by the way, Flash Player also is malware. They are so widely used that basically, if you're a user of proprietary software, you're almost certainly a victim of proprietary malware. Why do they do it? Well, it's not that they're sadists. They profit from mistreating users. Now, I won't claim that every proprietary program is malware. Most of them I have no knowledge about. It's not easy to find out whether a given proprietary program is malware or not. Some kinds of malicious functionalities are visible. Digital handcuffs are visible. Censorship is visible. The others, you can't tell if, well, you may find out somehow that they're there, but you can never prove they're not. So with any proprietary program, there are two possibilities. Either we know it's malware, or we just don't know. But there's no way to establish that it's not malware, which means the only way to trust it is with blind faith. Proprietary software does computing for suckers. And they have no shame about this either. They have conferences where they present their latest methods of mistreating users. Thirty-two years ago, when I started the free software movement, that was not the case. Proprietary software was an injustice. But most proprietary developers would not put in malicious functionality. And when any was found, it was shocking. It was a scandal. But nowadays, it mostly doesn't even create a scandal. It's expected that proprietary developers will use that proprietary software to wipe the floor with their users. So, if you're wise, you will not use proprietary software anymore. Escape and come to the free world that we have built with the GNU operating system plus the Linux kernel. We made the free world.
I started developing GNU in January 1984. The idea was to make a complete operating system that would be entirely free software. In 1992, we had basically all of GNU except one essential piece, the kernel. In February 1992, Mr. Torvalds liberated his kernel Linux. In 91, when he started it, it was not free software. It was under a license that had a restriction that was too much. However, in 92, he changed to a free software license, and the combination of GNU and Linux made a complete free operating system. For the first time, you could buy a PC and run it in freedom by installing the GNU plus Linux system. So, GNU plus Linux is basically a free operating system, but in practice, it's not always so. Because when people make the versions that they distribute of the GNU plus Linux system, nothing stops them from adding some other non-free programs. And in fact, this is a very common thing to do. And the result is a system that's not entirely freedom-respecting. You see, the system is a combination of thousands of pieces. In order for a collection of programs to respect your freedom, every piece, every component must respect your freedom. If there's one component that trashes your freedom, the combination as a whole trashes your freedom through that piece. So, in order for a distributed version of the system to be free, it must not have had any non-free pieces added to it. Unfortunately, of the more than 1,000 distributions that exist, nearly all have non-free pieces. There are just a few that are entirely freedom-respecting, and those are the ones we recommend. In gnu.org/distros, you can find information about which distros are free and which are not. And for the well-known distros which are non-free, we explain how so. Among the worst distros is Ubuntu. Ubuntu has a substantial amount of non-free software that it installs and more that it offers. And in addition, it's one of the rare examples of free software that spies on people. See gnu.org/philosophy/ubuntu-spyware.html. Now, why is it that free software doesn't usually spy on people? Why does proprietary software typically spy on people? Because the developers have power over the users, and they know it. And that tempts them to put in malicious functionalities. This power corrupts them. Well, in the free world, we developers know that we don't have power over the users, that the users control the program. We could put something in that's nasty and the users could take it out. Because power is to make it stay in there is what we don't have. And we know this, so we don't feel the same temptation. And as a result, generally, we stay honest. Free software is the only known defense against malware. When the users control the program, they generally get what they want. It's not a perfect defense, as Ubuntu proves, but it's the only known defense, and it's a lot better than being defenseless like proprietary software users. Now, beyond what's installed in your system and applications, there's other software that may run on your computer. Web pages often contain programs. They're written in the JavaScript language. That's a technical detail, but it's a good way to identify which programs we're talking about. So, as you browse the web,
sites may send these JavaScript programs to your browser, and then they run on your computer, and the browser doesn't even tell you. These programs can be free or non-free, just like any other program. Most of them are non-free. Now, I didn't want to run those non-free programs or any non-free programs on my computer. So for a while, I just kept JavaScript turned off. But now we have something called LibreJS. It's a program that analyzes all the JavaScript code in the web pages that tries to get into your browser to see if it's either trivial or free. And in those cases, it allows that JavaScript code to run. But if a program is non-trivial and non-free, LibreJS blocks it and warns you. And it does one other thing. It searches heuristically through the site for how to send complaints to the webmasters so that you can quickly and easily complain and say, I can't use your site because you have non-free JavaScript code. Please free your JavaScript code or make the site work without it. And otherwise, goodbye. It's very important to complain in this way. You don't have to go into the details because it will put those details in the message for you. So you can complain very quickly. There's one other way to lose control of your computing. And that is if you would trust it to somebody else's server. Actually, I just remembered there's one other point I should mention about JavaScript. Please raise your hand if you write JavaScript code. I'm looking for people to solve a problem. Some New York subway stations have Wi-Fi networks, which I can't connect to because the portal requires running non-free JavaScript code. I'm looking for somebody who wants to study that JavaScript code and see how it works and figure out a way to bypass it and post that, and then I'll be able to connect in the subway station. And so will other people be able to connect without running their non-free JavaScript code. Even better, once that step is done, someone could write a free extension for Firefox to do the same job as that JavaScript code, and thus, and since it will be free software, it'll solve the problem. Instead of running their non-free JavaScript code, you'll run this extension. It might also be written in JavaScript, but that's not a problem as long as it's free software. So this way, people will be able to use those Wi-Fi networks without running non-free software, and it will work smoothly for everyone. So please work on this if you want to make a difference. It's a fairly easy job compared with many other things that need doing. And it's something that those of you who are in that field have the skills for. So, back to service as a software substitute. That's when you entrust your own computing activity to somebody else's server. So you lose control over it. You don't control what that server is going to do. The server operator controls it. So, this is another way to lose control over your computing activity. The old way is do it with a non-free program. You have the non-free program in your computer, but you don't control what it does, so you don't control your computing. With service as a software substitute, you don't even have the copy of program that's doing your computing. It's a copy belonging to somebody else in his computer, so of course you have no control over it. Even if it's a free program, it's not your copy. If you have a copy of a free program, you have control over it, but this copy's not yours. So even if the server is doing your computing with a free program, you still don't control that computing. The server operator can change that copy. You can't. So, for control of your computing, you must reject SAS. So SAS is equivalent to running a non-free program in its effects, because you don't control what computing it does. But it's actually worse, because in order to use SAS, the user has to send all the pertinent data to the server. Now, as I explained, many non-free programs send the data they operate on to somebody's server, because they're spyware. Well, with SAS, the mechanism is different. The user explicitly sends the data, but it's the same result. The server has the user's data, and will probably show it to Big Brother. So, SAS is effectively equivalent to spyware, but it's worse. As I explained, many non-free programs have a universal backdoor that allows the developer to remotely impose software changes and thus change how the user's computing gets done without asking the user for permission to change it. Well, with SAS, the server operator, of course, can install different software in the server, and he should be free to do so. It's his computer. But this leads to bad consequences because that computer is doing somebody else's computing, not his computing. And so when he changes that software, he changes how all those users' computing gets done without asking them for permission to change it. So SAS, by the structure of how it works, is equivalent to running a non-free program which spies on the user and has a universal backdoor. It's the equivalent of malware, so don't use it. So we want to be free, but we have to cross some obstacles. One of them is the companies that impose their power on users through non-free software have accumulated lots of money with that, and they use that money to try to stop people from escaping. They do it through lobbying. They do it through essentially corrupting governments that were thinking of moving to free software. You know, if you pay a politician, that's a crime. But if you pay the state, that's not a crime. These companies can easily buy the state. And it's not a crime. They don't have to hide it. Legally, it's not considered corruption, but in practice, it is. For instance, they say, adopt this law we want, and we'll spend $1 million a year running a research center in your country or your state. Many governments will cheerfully change their policies in exchange for that. So when these companies show up to sell things, to recruit people, we have to protest them. Another obstacle is that many people don't even know about free software. They never talk about free software. They never hear anyone talk about free software. Instead, they hear discussion of something else, quote, open source, unquote, a term that I never use. This term was coined in 1998, that is 14 years after the start of the free software movement. It was meant to refer to the same set of programs, but completely hide the ethical issue. They intended to talk about all the free programs, exactly that much and no more. They used a definition that's written differently. So, in fact, the line didn't come out at exactly the same place. It turns out there are a few cases of programs that are open source but not free. They're rare. You'll probably never come across any source code that's open source but not free. It exists, but it's so unusual, you probably will not come across it. In practice, all free programs are open source, and almost all open source programs are free. But, so in practice, they're almost the same set of programs. But principle, they're as different as you can get because they're based on different values. Free software is an ethical issue. It's about your freedom and your community. The whole point of open source was to avoid talking about freedom, to avoid raising the issue as a matter of right or wrong. So, where we say, if you develop a program and distribute it, it's your moral duty to respect the user's freedom to change and redistribute the program. They say, if you develop and distribute a program, we suggest you consider letting the users change and redistribute it. It might be in your practical interest to do so, because then the users can improve the code quality. So, we say that developers have a moral obligation to respect the freedom of the users of their code. And that's what open source wants to forget. They do not wish to question that the moral legitimacy of proprietary software. That's too radical for them. They wanted to appeal to executives, so they decided to hush up anything executives might not like. And they didn't end up appealing to very many executives, but they sure succeeded in getting a lot of people to forget about the issue of right and wrong. So that's why I do not advocate or promote open source. I mostly don't go to activities that use the term open source, because whatever I'm doing, I wanted to promote the idea of free software as well. Where you stand is up to you, but if you agree with me, I hope you'll do the same as I do and insist on saying free software, not open source. Now, there's a lot of confusion about this point, about what constitutes free software and what constitutes open source. A program is free software if it's released under a free software license. There are many different free software licenses. The most commonly used one is the GNU General Public License. But that's not the only free software license. There are many more. The GNU GPL is a copyleft license. That means it has a particular condition, a requirement, saying if you redistribute copies, either exact or modified or extended, your copies must carry the same license. They must be distributed under the same terms. You must make the source code available. In other words, you must pass along to others the same freedom you got from us. We use copyleft because we want to make sure all users of the code get the freedom we aim to give them. But there are other free software licenses which don't do copyleft. Like there are two different BSD licenses. If somebody says the BSD license, he's confused because he's failing to say which one. And then there are other lax, permissive, pushover licenses. And then there are some that are sort of semi-copyleft. For more details, look at gnu.org/licenses/licenselist.html. You'll see dozens of free software licenses listed there, and dozens of other licenses which are non-free, and it says why. Those same licenses are also open source licenses, but there are some other open source licenses which are too restrictive, so they don't qualify as free. Fortunately, most of them are not used. And the rest of, all in all, those non-free open source licenses are used on very few programs. Well, in 1998, the majority of our community have held the open source philosophy, and they switched to using that term. And the companies in the community almost all switched to that term, and the journalists and politicians followed the businesses, and since then in the major media, you never see free software, you only see open source and open. The word open is warm and fuzzy and doesn't stand for anything in particular. And this was a great setback. It means that we have to work very hard to make people aware that the free software movement still is here. Some articles claimed that open source had replaced the free software movement, that we were just a precursor. Now, that was rather insulting of them. And when people hear about me, they generally hear the misinformation that claims I support open source. Every week, people write to me thanking me for what I've contributed to open source. So I have to politely explain to those people that they've been misinformed, that I don't agree with open source, never did, was never in favor of that, and I'm doing something that I think is more important and deeper, and that I hope they will support. And I show them the article gnu.org/philosophy/opensourcemissesthepoint.html. I've even seen articles that called me the father of open source. So I send a letter to the editor saying, if I'm the father of open source, it was conceived through artificial insemination using stolen sperm without my knowledge or consent. Then I explain the ideas and name of the free software movement, which were missing from the article, obviously, so that the readers of that periodical will see them. And that's the real point of the letter, but I like starting with a joke. Now, you can help this, too, just by insisting on saying free Libre software and not saying open source, especially when the people you're talking with are saying open source. You can help spread awareness of the free software movement. We need this help very much. And another obstacle is when there's hardware that we can't write free software for because its specs are secret. Very often, the manufacturer will sell you the product and refuse to tell you how to use it. They say, here's a non-free program to control the hardware. Run it and shut up. Well, obviously, we shouldn't run it. So what do we need to do? We need reverse engineering. We need to figure out the specs of that product, figure out how to run it. We need to figure out what the commands are to make it do things and write that down. And then that will show someone else how to write a free program to run that hardware. We have lots of people who can do that, but the reverse engineering is the hard job. If you want to make a big technical contribution to the free world, do reverse engineering. And schools that teach technical fields should have courses in reverse engineering. It's a very important field, and I'm told that there is that people are in great demand. So it's a lucrative career as well. But above all, schools should teach free software. They should teach free software in the sense that when they have the students use a program, it better be free. But in addition, the school should teach students why they have that policy. They should teach students the civics of free software. And every class should have a rule against distributing non-free software there, because distributing or teaching how to use it, because giving kids proprietary software is like giving them tobacco. It's
getting them hooked, making them dependent. And that's why proprietary software companies often offer gratis or cheap copies of their non-free software to schools or children to get them addicted, just as tobacco companies used to offer them gratis cigarettes. The school should refuse on principle to participate in getting students hooked on these non-free programs. And the class should say, don't bring non-free software to class unless it's for reverse engineering. Every class should have the following rule for the sake of moral education. Students, if you bring software to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share it with the rest of the class, including the source code in case someone here wants to learn, because this class is a place where we share our knowledge. Therefore, it's not permitted to bring proprietary software to class unless it's for reverse engineering. The school, to set a good example, must follow its own rule. It must bring only free software to class with source code and share copies with everyone in the class that wants them, except for the exercises for reverse engineering practice. But there's another reason, and that is for the sake of education. You see, every program embodies knowledge. If it's proprietary, that knowledge is secret. It's withheld from the students. If it's free software, the program offers its knowledge to the students. So the free program supports education, and the non-free program is the enemy of education. It's the enemy of the spirit of education and should never be tolerated in a school. Schools must show their loyalty to the spirit of education. They must not betray that spirit for some minor convenience. Human rights depend on each other. If you lose one, if one is taken out, the others tend to collapse because we can't defend them anymore. Now that we use software for so many important activities, free software, control over our computing, is one of the human rights that we need in order to defend the other human rights. We must insist on it. And we must look at any non-free program as a temptation for us to surrender our human rights. Sometimes defending your freedom requires a sacrifice. I've met people who said, oh, I'll be happy to switch to free software when you provide me a free program that does absolutely everything this non-free program does equally, easily, and I won't lose the tiniest little bit. What that person is saying is that for him, freedom is worth exactly zero. Of course, those people will lose their freedom. To keep your freedom, you have to defend it. That has always been true, and it's true in our field as well. So there may be a thing you can't do with your computer, because to do it, you'd have to give up your freedom, and that is, or should be, unthinkable. So how can you help the cause? Well, if you're a programmer, you can write free software. But if you're not a programmer, there are many important things you can do. You can organize to campaign for the use of free software. You can learn to be a speaker and present these ideas in your way to other people. That's a tremendously important contribution. You can persuade schools and governments to migrate to free software. Look at gnu.org/education and gnu.org/philosophy/government-free-software.html. You can help other users, for instance, start a GNU/Linux user group.
And just saying free software helps us. So, at this point, I'd like to mention a little more about where to get more information. GNU.org/licenses gives all the information about free software licensing. In licenserecommendations.html, you'll see information, suggestions for how to choose a license for your work. You'll also find in that directory information about the correct way to apply for GNU General Public License or GNU GPL and other GNU licenses. It's very important to go through those steps carefully and apply it correctly. Especially on GitHub, you will find many examples of programs in which the licensing is ambiguous. GitHub is a very bad influence in this regard. You'll also find many programs with no stated license at all. Those programs are not free software. They're also not open source for whatever that's worth, for the same reasons, because there's no license giving users any permissions. So users have no permissions. The way copyright law works today is everything that's written is automatically copyrighted, and by default, you're not allowed to copy it or change it or basically do anything with it. And that makes the program non-free unless there's a free software license that gives the users the four freedoms. That's what a free software license is for. That's why we use them. It's the statement by the copyright holder saying, yes, you're allowed to do these things. And without that statement, the program is non-free. GNU.org/distros gives the information about which distros are free and the widely used ones that are non-free. GNU.org/philosophy addresses many political issues. GNU.org/proprietary gives information about many examples of malicious functionalities found in a wide range of proprietary programs. It's organized by type of malware and by company that's responsible. By the way, Volkswagen showed us a new kind of malicious functionality recently, Lieware. So now that example is in there along with the spying Barbie doll and the spying TVs and all the other nasty things. And GNU.org/GNU gives information about about the history of the GNU system. By the way, the name GNU is a recursive acronym. It stands for GNU's Not Unix. And this is an adorable GNU that needs a home. So, we also have the site fsf.org for the Free Software Foundation. Every month we send out a mailing. If you'd like to receive the mailing, you can write your email address down on the paper outside. You can join the Free Software Foundation. That's our main source of funds, is members' dues. So please do join. You can do it through fsf.org if you wish to pay digitally, or you can fill out a piece of paper here and give me cash, if you prefer, as I do, to avoid digital payments. This button says, don't be trapped, pay cash. And I follow my own advice very thoroughly. So now it's time to present my other identity.
am Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. Emacs started out as an extensible text editor program that I had written, but developed over the years into a way of life for many users, as it was extended so much they could do all their computing without ever leaving Emacs. And then it became a church with the launch of the news group alt.religion.emacs, which you might find amusing to visit. In the Church of Emacs, we have a great schism between several versions of Emacs, and we also have saints, but fortunately no gods. Instead of gods, we adore the one true editor, Emacs. To be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must pronounce the confession of the faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. Then, if you become a true expert, you can celebrate that with our ceremony, the Fubar Mitzvah, in which you chant a portion of our sacred scripture, that is to say, the system source code. In the Church of Emacs, we have eliminated the priesthood of technology because everyone is free to read our sacred scripture. We also have the cult of the Virgin of Emacs, which refers to anyone who has never used Emacs. According to the Church of Emacs, offering the opportunity to lose Emacs virginity is a blessed act. We also have the Emacs pilgrimage, which consists of invoking all the commands of Emacs in alphabetical order. There is a breakaway Tibetan sect which claims that it's sufficient to invoke them automatically under the control of a script. However, the mainstream church holds that to gain spiritual merit, you must type them by hand. The Church of Emacs has certain advantages compared with other churches I won't name. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. However, it does require living a life of moral purity. You must exorcise the evil proprietary operating systems that have possessed computers under your control or set up for your regular use, and install a wholly free operating system. And then use and install only free software with and on the system. By the way, I hope you noticed that holy free system, in holy free system, the word holy can be spelled in more than one way. If you make this vow and you live by it, then you too will be a saint and you'll have the right to wear a halo if you can find one, because they don't make them anymore. There is a traditional rivalry between Emacs and the other text editor, VI. So people occasionally ask me if, in the Church of Emacs, using VI is a sin. It's true that VI is the editor of the beast. But using a free implementation of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. Last year I went to China, and I was shocked that some VI users proposed getting together to attack me. What can I say? Apparently, violence begins with VI. People have occasionally asked whether my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous existence. Thank you.
Now it's time for the auction.